Politics Uncensored with Ali Milani and Zoe Grunewald on Fubar Radio.
Hello, you're listening to Politics Uncensored with me, Ali Milani. No Zoe in the studio, so you've just got to deal with me. Coming up on today's show, we'll be bringing you the latest as the race for the Makerfield by-election begins. Then, following on from Trump's visit to Beijing last week, China's premier begins talks with Vladimir Putin. We'll unpack why the timings of these meetings matter. As always, you can find us at Politics Uncensored UK on social media. But first, it's the Week Unwrapped. Like I said, there's no Zoe in the studio, but joining us for the first half of the show is Martha Gill, political journalist. Martha, thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks very much for having me.
Hopefully you get through your sentences better than I did at the beginning of this show. That's why Zoe is usually in this chair. We're going to start off with some breaking news from today. The first batch of files relating to Andrew Mountbatten-Windsor as trade envoy in 2001 have been released by the government. Earlier this year, lawmakers agreed to publish the documents relating to the appointment after the disgraced royal was arrested on suspicion of misconduct in public office. The pages reveal that there are no formal due diligence or vetting processes undertaken prior to his appointment. The question here, again, seems to be another role in the UK state that doesn't have any vetting or any processes behind who can be appointed. Now, it should be said that I think this particular appointment, which the Queen was very, very keen on, happened before some of the furor with his relations with Jeffrey Epstein, certainly staying in his townhouse. Do you think, you know, what can we take away from these files? How concerned should we be that another really important role, there was no formal due diligence or vetting process?
Well, yeah, I mean, I think the thing with this, and it links to the Mandelson vetting scandal, is it's just showing us how, like, you know, status and connections kind of substitute for vetting or have substituted for vetting in government. I mean, this is kind of amazing that Andrew had this role with all this access to confidential information, including commercial information, which we now know he used. And there weren't even the most basic checks that you'd run on a junior civil servant. And basically, what the files also show, kind of interestingly, is like officials were managing him like they might manage a celebrity. So, you know, his aide told the government that he preferred to go to sophisticated countries and to see ballet rather than theatre, and that he shouldn't be offered private golfing functions abroad, and that, you know, he had to take his own clubs with him and all this stuff.
And all of this stuff is, obviously, he's not paid for the role, but all his expenses and travel and the accompanying staff are paid for.
Yeah.
Sounds more like a little holiday that's paid for by the state than it does a trade envoy, no?
Exactly, yeah.
I guess, if you're a voter, how concerned are you with the level of, I guess, political involvement of the royals here? Because a trade envoy can be, a very, very important role.
Right.
But it's given to him by nature of his bloodline with no checks, no qualifications. I'm asking, is this much ado about nothing, or should we be concerned?
Well, I think we should be concerned. I think this is a story, like, I mean, a royalist would say, like, you know, the soft power of the royals are very important.
And we just saw it work with King Charles, with Trump.
Exactly. And this is exactly the kind of role that they should have, kind of opening doors abroad.
Doors only to the ballet.
Right. But I think the problem comes when it intersects with the state, where basically you have these unelected people who aren't civil servants. They can't really be sacked. They can't, then, like, the vetting process doesn't really know how to handle them because they're a royal. And so what are you going to do? You're going to say, actually, no, they're not fit for this role. You can't really say that. We've shown that is a problem. So I think the solution is to leave the royals out of these specific kind of government-backed roles, quasi-government roles, and just to let them do what they have been doing, which is be royals.
How damaging do you think this whole sort of scandal has been with the royals? Obviously, we now know, I mean, the former prince stood down from this role in 2011 over his ties to the convicted sex offender Jeffrey Epstein, whom part of the drama is that he stayed in the townhouse while Epstein was in prison, certainly after he'd been prosecuted. You know, Andrew continued to stay in royal accommodations, continued at least for a little while to hold official positions. Do you think this whole thing has been damaging to the royals, or are we all where we started, which is basically the Republicans think this is a big, big problem and the royalists ignore it?
I think it all hinges on whether or not you kind of take the royals' suggestion that they've basically walled him off from the monarchy. Mm. Now they've dropped his title of prince. They've removed his other title, so there is some accountability.
Yeah, he's now
there.
Andrew Mountbatten Windsor, which couldn't get more double barrel posh.
Yeah, we can't stop him from being posh, but yeah. We've apparently tried to stop him from being royal. But I think that actually that you can't. I mean, the whole point of the royals is you get it from being related to another royal.
Yeah.
So you can't really. It's sort of this weird institution that can't really have those accountabilities. Like, oh, you can be a royal if you deserve it, and you stop being a royal if you don't deserve it. So yeah, I think on balance, this has damaged the royals because he will keep. I mean, the late queen was brought into this story as well today. And so the fact is that that's a problem with royalty, isn't it?
So we should say why these files are being published now. The government agreed to publish the Andrew files appointment on his appointments after the Lib Dems used a mechanism known as a humble address back in February. This was after the former prince's arrest. They described Andrew as rude, arrogant, and entitled, and said the government would comply with the motion as fast as we possibly can. One of the documents is a media Q&A for the Duke of York royal announcement. It's seemingly written by the British Trade International about Andrew's appointment as trade envoy. It says no one else was approached for the trade envoy role and there was no trade limits for his appointment as the role is open-ended. Question 8 in that Q&A, which is the last thing I want to ask you on this, is, but he is not very experienced. Why not someone better placed? So they knew at the time that he didn't have the right qualifications for this role.
No.
Right? So he's only getting it by nature of the Queen is really keen for him to get it.
And his
royal connection. So we were, again, it's like ultimate Nepo baby, right?
Well, yeah. I mean, yeah, the royals
you can't
are.
Get more you can't get more ultimate Nepo baby.
Yeah, completely. I think what's kind of interesting about this is the government is like so candid about it. They don't normally, I mean, yeah, the Lib Dems force them to do it, but you wouldn't normally get a government publishing a document that says, yeah, we never checked.
Yeah.
So this just shows there's now more risk involved in being seen to protect him than like exposing your failure.
And I think post Mandelson, post Andrew, there's obviously a major conversation about vetting and process in all sorts of departments of government are appointing everything from ambassador right, something lighter now. We're moving on to Russia. The UK apparently loosens Russian oil sanctions. This week, the UK government has loosened strict sanctions on Russian oil as concern over supplies grow as a result of the effective blockade of the Strait of Hormuz. Since the start of the US-Israel war in Iran, fuel prices have skyrocketed, which has had a huge knock-on effect on the UK industry. The government has expressed the need to be flexible, but in the meantime has signed a G7 statement reaffirming its unwavering commitment to impose severe costs on Russia. I think I've seen today Zelensky has said that the Ukrainians are kind of looking into what these new quote-unquote loosened sanctions are. The government are denying it. They're saying none of the old sanctions have changed. This is a question about new sanctions. What do you make of this? Because There's two elements to it, right? Mm. There's the moral element and actually the security element of standing up to Russia and making sure we apply as much diplomatic pressure on Russia. But then there's the sort of realpolitik, some people will say, with the Strait of Hormuz and the war in Iran, prices are just very expensive.
Right. So, I mean, at the same time as saying we're committing to sanctions, we're kind of watering them down by closing off this loophole, right? By opening up this loophole that we'd previously said we're going to close. So, how seriously are we going to take these commitments? But you could say at the same time, the UK has led the world on economic sanctions. We want to make life difficult for Russia, but not at the price of crippling ourselves. And then that says we're not being hypocritical. But then that's sending the signal to Russia that there's a ceiling on the sanctions as well. So I think that's the knot that we're dealing with.
Yeah,
right,
I think the average price of unleaded petrol, should be said, is at 158p. 0.52p, I guess £1.58 a litre on Monday. I know, because I put petrol in my car on Monday and it was really painful. It's the highest since the start of the war.
Yeah.
Now, we don't have any data on this, but let's speculate, because that's what I like to do when Zoe's not here. I'm not a journalist and she is, so when she's not here, I just make it up. Do you think people care? Like, ordinary folks going to the put petrol in their car, see that it's expensive, they might, like, in theory, support stronger actions on Russia. But do you think they'll look at this and go, you know what, it just needs to get cheaper, so I don't care where it comes from?
Yeah,
or do you think they do have like a, do you think generally the population, the UK broadly, has like a moral position on this that they're concerned about?
Yeah, well, my speculation is that people wouldn't be prepared to go beyond a certain threshold.
Yeah.
Just to support the war. And we don't know where that threshold is. Maybe we've reached it now.
Mm.
So yeah, I mean, cost of living. Yeah, I think a lot of people will balk at this.
Yeah.
I mean, the thing is,
the government's trying to do both, right?
It's
signing the G7 statement, reaffirming unwavering commitment to impose severe costs on Russia, but not quite so severe, because it's at 158 and Ali can't afford 160.
I think that's what they're doing. I mean, you know, I think a lot of people might agree with that pragmatism, right? You know,
yeah, that's what I was asking. Yeah, like,
I think that's something that, but the trouble is, maybe that puts, maybe like putting sanctions on, but up to a certain point, undermines the whole credibility of sanctions, right? Because you're basically saying to Moscow, keep going, because the resolve of the coalition has a price ceiling.
And I guess that's something which will be brought up certainly with Donald Trump, Benjamin Netanyahu, as the war continues, because it's two fronts, right? The reason this is happening is because of the closure of the Strait of Hormuz and the broader economic impacts and oil impacts that has.
Yeah.
So it's, none of it is not connected.
Yeah.
Right, let's move on. The final story is that the UK formally assesses a bid for England to host the Olympics in the 2040s. Many of us remember 2012 when it was held in London. But this time it looks like it's going to go to the north. So ministers have commissioned UK Sport to assess whether the competition could return to Britain. This time, though, in the north of the country. I don't know if you've seen Sadiq Khan is at the roof on this, saying this will be a missed opportunity for London. And I'm sure somewhere in the north, Andy Burnham is jumping up and down and talking about how much he loves the north and how much the Olympics needs to come to the north. Before we get to the Olympics themselves, what do you make of this like north-south stuff that's going on in the country right now? There seems to be more of a...
It's definitely a moment for the north-south stuff, which is kind of, I don't know, we heard a lot of bit around Brexit, then it's kind of petered it out and now it's come back. Is it just a fact of Andy Burnham, you know,
going to
potentially be the next Labour leader, bringing it, and then this story adding together?
You know what? I think if he becomes Labour leader and Prime Minister, he's the first Prime Minister to represent a northern constituency in like donkey years, maybe around the war. I'm going to someone fact check me on that. But I think it is significant.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
It's certainly true. I've been in Makerfield this week, and it's certainly true that part of the country feels unrepresented. Whether that perception is real or not, that's a whole separate point.
Yeah.
But there is definitely like a conscious feeling in the north of England that the south gets all the money and all the black political priorities.
Yeah. So if there could be an Olympics coming to the north. Yeah.
Well, that's what brings us back to the Olympics. Do you remember the 2012 Olympics?
I do. Yeah.
Did you go?
I was in
you're
London.
In London.
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. So what do you make of this? Do you think it's important? How much of an impact do things like Olympics, World Cups, Euros, like that sort of sports stuff
have? Yeah, it's genuinely significant, I think. You're kind of beamed into living rooms worldwide. It's this kind of, you know, for us, particularly the UK, like this mid-sized power that's basically declining.
Yeah.
We culture, soft power is like our one remaining strength that we've got. And this is, there's definitely a dividend. I mean, the trouble is, it's really hard to quantify.
That can go in the bid.
Sorry.
can go in the bid. This is all we have, guys. Come on, help us out. Yeah.
But yeah, I think it's like, it's a really high reward thing. And there are genuinely like, economic dividends as well, although the government's launching this kind of consultation into that, because of course there are downsides as well, like, you know, gentrification, it pushes people out, and then there are like sort of white elephants that then never really get used. I think it would be a good thing. And so
London has hosted the Olympics three times.
Yeah.
1908, 1948 and 2012. But no other part of the UK ever has ever hosted parts of the Olympics. And look, there's plenty of stadiums up there. Old Trafford, Anfield.
Yeah. I mean, that's the general pattern, right? I mean, countries, their capital cities host the Olympics generally.
Yeah.
Right.
So Culture Secretary Lisa Nandy said London 2012 showed what the Olympics can do for our country. It inspired a generation through sport, attracted huge investment, and showed the best of Britain to the world. So do you think this is a good idea, just a Northern Olympics?
Yeah, why not? I think you're right. There's plenty of stadiums up there. And 2012 was a genuinely optimistic moment. I mean, that's what Nandy's kind of reaching back to, that moment.
I think it should be London again.
You think it should be London? Why?
Because everything should be in London and Andy can just get over it. That's it from the Week Unwrapped. We'll be back with Martha. She's going to stay in the studios with us. We're going to talk a little bit more about the Makerfield by-election. We'll bring you the latest, what's going on up there. Stay tuned and join us after this.
Politics Uncensored with Ali Milani and Zoe Grunewald on FUPAR Radio. Follow us at Politics Uncensored UK for more from the show.
Welcome back. You're listening to Politics Uncensored with me, Ali Milani. And joining us still in the studio is Martha. Martha, thank you for staying with us. We're going to talk a little bit about Andy Burnham, the North, the Makerfield by-election. Mm. Just been talking in the break. You're also a Londoner like me. So we've got two Londoners talking about the North. Somewhere Andy's is will definitely...
What an unusual combination. Yeah. I've seen that before.
We'll definitely be burning. So the reason that this by-election is so significant... Mm. Is not least because the mayor of Greater Manchester will be standing, but it's kind of being seen by most as a sort of leadership pitch, not really by much stealth.
Right.
And the view is that if he is able to win the Makerfield by-election, it paves the way for him to potentially challenge Keir Starmer's leadership, becoming prime minister. Now, he recently released a campaign video. Let's listen to some of that campaign footage now.
Westminster doesn't work for people in this part of the world and communities like this across the UK. Some say this by-election is unnecessary. I say it's the most consequential of our lives. I don't take anything for granted and I'm ready to accept the consequences of whatever choice people make.
Well, we need somebody that's one of the people, that's somebody that understands the common person. We need somebody like him for the next prime minister, because he will be, definitely.
So, it's pretty clear in the campaign video, right? Prime Minister, Westminster versus us. That's very much the framing he's going for.
Yeah, and it's quite unusual that a British politician is able to do that, right? To position themselves as an outsider... to Westminster, because
especially someone who holds public office consistently, he's the mayor,
right? Because you simply can't normally the run of the mill pathway is you can't establish yourself as a serious contender outside Westminster.
Yeah.
But with the mayoralties, for the first time, you can. So he's really using that, and I think that
seems to have changed, doesn't it? Because now with these regional elected offices, you can be a public office holder,
right,
where people
Boris
know
Johnson.
Your name. Yeah.
Yeah.
But also be an outsider.
Exactly. Right. Yeah, yeah. 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 So that's
definitely what they're going for. So Reform have also picked their candidate. What's his name? Kenyon something. I should know this.
Robert Kenyon.
Kenyon. There you go. He's also got a plumber, right? So they've learned from Gorton and Denton. Clearly.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
And they've kind of launched their campaign as a sort of David and Goliath, ordinary plumber versus sort of political Goliath. Now, why this seat is really interesting is it could be a microcosm for the country, right? Reform, Labour are in government, but Reform are topping all the polls. If Andy can be seen to defeat Reform in this by-election, he kind of, it's a test of concept, right? You can tell the whole Labour Party, I'm the guy that can beat Reform.
Right, but if he loses to the Reform candidate...
I think there's problems if he loses.
I think there's problems because the public will then question whether any Labour candidate can do it. And, you know, Starmer will still be Prime Minister for a bit, probably.
Yeah.
But the idea that he's going to be Labour's last Prime Minister is...
So the question... I think that is the question. If Andy loses, then... The conversation certainly happening in the Labour Party. He's the most popular politician the Labour Party has, no question. It's not even close.
Yeah.
And if he can't win a Northern seat,
every single
Labour MP,
and he's the
will
most
be permanently
kind of...
sat on the toilet, shitting it. No?
Right, because he's got kind of everything going for him in that seat as much as he possibly can. We saw in that video, he's very, very good at communicating authenticity. He has lots of links with the area. Yeah, he wasn't born there like the Reform candidate, but he sends his kids to school there. He went to school there. He's walking up and down the street. People know who he is. Yeah, it's going to be a bit of an existential crisis for the Labour Party.
Okay, let's assume he wins for a second.
Yeah.
Right. What do you think happens next? Because the polling internally in the Labour Party that's been released shows he beats all other candidates quite comprehensively. The only other person who's kind of formally said that they would stand in a leadership election is Wes Streeting.
Yeah.
But his polling is pretty dire.
Right.
I mean, most people are predicting that it'll be a coronation. If he comes into Westminster having beaten a Reform candidate, proof of concept, most popular politician, you know, he beats anyone else in a leadership election, he becomes Prime Minister. Is that the way you see it, or do you think it could be more complex than that?
Yeah, I mean, it's kind of difficult to say. It's this moving picture. I mean, yeah, Streeting's gone a bit quiet at the moment.
Yeah. I mean, I would too if I was polling 4%. I'd go very quiet if I was polling.
Right, and Rain is not polling much better, right?
Yeah.
So I think you're just looking at that polling alone, although maybe they're not going to go just by the polling,
yeah,
but that's a bad sign.
Yeah. I mean, I assume that's why Streeting didn't mount a challenge,
yeah,
right? Because there was a moment when we all thought he's going to go, right?
Yeah,
because
yeah.
Right after the locals, Andy hadn't yet announced a by-election and people thought he had the 81. I personally did think he had the 81. But something seemed to stop him, and then this poll drops only a few days later. So maybe he was looking at similar numbers.
Yeah, it's kind of difficult to say. I mean, what do you think?
Well, I think that's what happened. I think Wes wants to be Prime Minister, but I think what needed to happen for him is he needs to come out of the cabinet, because I think he was looking at polling. He wasn't polling very well, and I think he needed to come as an outsider. I think him running from within the cabinet would have been too much continuity Starmer versus an outsider, whether it's Rayner or...
Yeah, although it's interesting that if you look at the YouGov polling of Labour members, they're actually very satisfied with the government.
Are they?
Yeah, it's like 80% approval of Yeah, 66% of members think Starmer's done a good job, and 80% say the party's done a good job in government. They just don't like Starmer.
Yeah, yeah. It seems to be
so,
the way.
So, I mean, continuity may not be
okay,
an
let
issue.
Okay, let me ask you this. There's not an issue. I'm just going to... Why is he so unpopular? I've been door-knocking all through the locals. I've never met a politician this unpopular before.
Yeah.
Why is he so reviled by the voters?
Well, you know, I feel like part of it is his presentation, right?
Yeah.
He's like... He's very, very bad at communication.
Yeah.
He's incredibly wooden.
Uniquely
and that's
bad,
your whole
yeah.
job. You're supposed to be the front man for what your party is
yeah.
doing.
Did you see him? You know he's an Arsenal fan.
Yeah.
Did you see him after Arsenal? Even him celebrating the Arsenal victory. I saw someone tweet that said, I know he's a fan of football, but when he talks about football, it makes me think he's never watched a football game in his life. That's how bad of a communicator he is, right?
Yeah. I think that's it. And also, he's kind of showing what happens when you aren't strongly led by a kind of a vision, a plan,
yeah.
an ideology, and you're sort of doing these pragmatic compromises.
That's
what I said, which is where I think that might the sort of idea that of continuity of that particular flaw might be where Streeting falls down, because he is also quite a pragmatic politician. He does have quite strong ideology, but he's also he's very focused on policy solutions, and he's willing to take on kind of tricky territory. He's actually a very skilled communicator, so he's willing to take on these sort of tricky bits of treacherous political territory and find a way through in a way that is kind of clever, but may not be immediately kind of an ideological stance that the whole party can get behind, like Burnham.
Yeah. Do you? I'm curious as to how you think this will play out. Obviously, we don't have data and numbers right now, but what's your gut telling you? And you've also, I don't think, been in Makerfield. But do you think Burnham goes through? Just where the country is, do you think he can survive?
Yeah, I don't. It's like Reform is very much has the wind at its back, right? But my gut is that he's kind of a celebrity politician. I think he's very popular there.
I
think he will just squeak it, even though it might be very close.
I will tell you this. I've been out there for about a week, and I'm very skeptical, always have been, about politicians who claim popularity or a personal vote. But it was definitely true. When I was there, yeah, I heard more than one person tell me that they voted Reform in the locals or they didn't vote Labour in the locals and they would vote for Andy. I also uniquely heard this thing that I ran against Boris in 2019 and I experienced this as a candidate, and then I heard this on the doorstep with Andy. People were excited about the prospect of the Prime Minister being in their seat because they were like, surely he'll fix the high street, right? Because he'll be Prime Minister. He'll have to, right? He'll have, with like Makerfield will have unique insight into power or unique access into power. So I tend to agree with you. I think he'll be close, but I think he'll get through. If he does, do you think he's Labour's best bet? Because YouGov poll shows that YouGov polled people saying essentially where Labour is now, and then what if Labour was led by Andy Burnham, and they went from 7 points behind Reform to 3 points ahead of Reform. So he gives Labour a significant bump in the polls. Do you think he's the, forget like your own political ideology and political positioning, just from an electoral perspective, is he Labour's best chance in the next general election?
Yeah, you're right. You're right that the public numbers back this, that he has more personal popularity, and that is really important. I think he probably is.
Yeah.
Because I think that's the thing that's missing now. I mean, Labour's done some pretty good stuff. Right. There's just no coherency to it, and that's what they need.
And yeah, I guess that's why the first campaign video was.
I think that's right. Yeah,
was as seemed to excite people, but it's a very very tricky seat, and he's going to have to balance a sort of Reform curious Makerfield constituency with a Labour membership who is probably well to the left of his constituents, which.
True, but they're so aware of the threat from Reform.
Yeah.
I don't know, yeah.
Okay, make some predictions, right? So I can tweet them at you later. who is Prime Minister come September?
Let's say...
So if party conference is end of September, early October, who is Prime Minister at Labour Party? Who's the Prime Minister that gives the speech at Labour Party conference?
Might be Burnham.
Do you think so? I think it'll be Andy Burnham as well. I think Andy Burnham will be the Prime Minister, the Labour Prime Minister that gives the speech at Labour Party conference. I think so.
I don't think Starmer can carry on. It's a question of when.
If Andy doesn't win, is there any chance it's Starmer? Do you think he survives, or do you think it'll be Streeting, Rayner? Because I think he'll. So here's what I think. And we're doing lots of speculating. I can't quite see my producer, so if she doesn't like it, she'll tell me. I think if Andy loses in Makerfield, I think there'll be an immediate challenge. Because I think it's exactly what you said earlier. People will go, well, if Andy can't win, we're fucking goosed.
There'll be panic.
Yeah. If I'm an MP, I'm panicking. So in that scenario, who's the Prime Minister that gives...
Okay, so what have we got? We've got Andy's, Streeting,
so Rayner. So here's where we are. We've said that if Andy Burnham wins Makerfield, we think Andy Burnham...
will be by September.
By September will be Prime Minister.
Because the challenge will be triggered as soon as he wins.
Well, we're actually saying October, because party conference is in October. Okay. So by October, he'll be Prime Minister. If Andy doesn't win Makerfield, who are we saying?
You still think there'll be an immediate trigger and a challenge? Out of panic. I think there'll be a bit of a delay. I think people will gather themselves and there'll be a bit more of sort of Starmer kind of lame duck kind of you know, the sort of outgoing leader, perhaps.
Yeah. I think it might be worth Streeting.
You think it might be Streeting, yeah.
Yeah. But I don't think that'll help. Ironically enough, I don't think that'll help. But it could be Starmer, I guess. I think there'll be an immediate challenge. I think there'll be absolute panic. Mm-hmm. I think the view will be that if the most popular Labour politician can't win this seat, there'll be absolute...
Then no one can, but why would that... I mean, that'll just be... Yeah. I mean, why wouldn't it... May as well be Starmer if no one can do it.
What does it do to Reform if he wins, if Andy wins? Do they see him as a significant threat, do you think?
Yeah, I think he is the biggest threat to them, because he's from the part of the world that they have the most success within. Mm-hmm. He's hitting a lot of the buttons that they are hitting.
They'll also be looking at the same poll that we're looking at, which he gives them Labour a 3-point lead on them. Yeah,
yeah, I think he is a challenge to Reform, but I think as ever, what we've seen with Reform is that they are able to just go a little bit further than the main parties that kind of imitate them or challenge them on their ground.
Yeah.
We've seen that Reform is prepared to, can kind of meet that challenge and go beyond it.
And that would be the main challenge for Andy, I think. If he's Prime Minister, you can't keep doing the outsider stuff.
Exactly.
If you're Prime Minister.
Well, yeah.
Which they'll continue to be able to do, right, Reform. Although, weirdly,
Reformer able to have the brass neck to continue being like the outsider even when they are
inside,
like a major. Yeah. So I wonder whether Burnham will be able to. I mean, look at Donald Trump's shtick.
That's
he's still the outsider, even though he's president. That's a very good point.
Yeah, you could. I guess Donald Trump is a good example that you can still be like a political
outsider.
You can
outsider. Say you're there, you're cleaning it up.
Yeah. The state's fighting against you, and the system is broken. And you know what? Andy is big on like the electoral system, how broken democracy is, and like broken, like the state doesn't work for us. That could work.
Yeah. If he's able to pull that off, is he?
Yeah.
I mean, it takes a certain amount of delusion to be able to keep saying that when you are prime minister.
I don't know if Andy Burnham has that in him. You need a Donald Trump level of delusion.
Farage definitely does.
Yeah. But it's important because I think the common thread that unites people across the country is that Westminster doesn't work.
Right.
Which was the beginning of, I mean, if we play this video.
Westminster doesn't work for people.
It's like the first things he says, right?
Yeah, and I think he can carry on saying that for a while until it becomes obvious that as Prime Minister, obvious that actually he should have been doing something by now.
Yeah.
But so it does work for a bit.
We've done all the predicting, and we'll try and get you back on off in the end of October and see.
Yeah, I'd love to come on.
And we'll play it and we'll see which one of us was, I mean, we pretty much agreed on a lot of it, but we'll see if we were right. After the break, we'll be unpacking why the timing of Putin's visit to China matters. Donald Trump has just been there. Questions about Taiwan. Stay tuned as we come back and talk about China, Putin, and the United States.
It's Ali Milani and Zoe Grunewald with Politics Uncensored. FUBAR Radio.
Welcome back. You're listening to me, Ali Milani, on Politics Uncensored. I don't know why I did the sentence that way around. I've never done it that way around. Welcome back. I just wanted to quickly shout out Martha's, who was just joining us for the Week Unwrapped in the last segment, her social. So it's Martha_Gill on X if you want to follow her. And she writes lots of cool stuff in The Guardian. So do check that out if you get a chance. Let's move on to Donald Trump and his departure from China last week. So just 24 hours after the US president left China, Xi Jinping organized another round of diplomatic talks, this time with Russia's Vladimir Putin. The Russian president touched down in Beijing on Tuesday, confident that despite the US's touting of trade deals, there's little evidence of significant progress for Washington and Beijing. So what do the timings of these meetings mean for China's position between these rival powers? You will have also noticed, I noticed certainly, Donald Trump's rowing back of a historic American sort of security guarantee of Taiwan as well. So is the US's position changing in the region? Joining us to tell us more and help us unpack this is George Magnus, research associate at the China Center, Oxford University, and at SOAS, an author of Red Flags, Why Xi's China is in Jeopardy. Mr. Magnus, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Assuming our audience, doesn't know a whole lot about China, America, and Russia's sort of relationship, how significant are these two rounds of talks? The first between Xi Jinping and Donald Trump, and the second happening very frequently after with Vladimir Putin.
Well, let's kind of break it down into kind of three relationships, really. So the U.S.-China relationship obviously is absolutely central to, you know, what's going on in the world, and has been for quite some time. And I think that if I can just be, you know, very kind of catch-all about this, I think that the meeting between Trump and Xi Jinping, which actually had been postponed because it was supposed to happen earlier, but they obviously put it back because of what was going on in Iran. I mean, this meeting was always going to be what I call a timeout meeting, right? Both sides need some time out to recalibrate and figure out how to plot and plan the next stages of what is an eternal adversarial relationship. So I don't think anybody was expecting any great fireworks from this meeting. Trump called Xi Jinping his best pal, and Xi Jinping is very respectful to Trump. But they know that they're on opposite sides of a massive, relationship that actually isn't going to improve. And they're both, in a way, playing for time, and both of the leaders have reasons to do that. Putin is something else entirely, because There's no love lost really between Russia and China, and some of the listeners may be aware, some not, that many years ago, well, so back in the 60s, they actually fought a short war together, and they were ideological adversaries for quite some time. But things have moved on since then, obviously, and the one thing that they have in common, of course, is they both want to undermine the United States and NATO, and they both want to take advantage of what they think is the disunity going on currently between America and its allies. So the meeting between Putin and Xi Jinping was planned, obviously, in advance as well. They were supposed to be talking about a pipeline that the Russians want to build for gas to flow to China. But this is something that Putin needs more than the Chinese do. And I'm not sure, as far as I can tell, whether they actually agreed to press ahead with this pipeline or not.
So let's deal with, you're right, because there's various components here. Let's deal with the Trump-Xi Jinping one first and the US-Chinese one. A lot of us were surprised to hear Donald Trump's comments specifically around Taiwan, his calling of Xi Jinping is like his best pal and the friendly nature in which he does it. But you're kind of suggesting that, no, there wasn't many headlines and fireworks. Is this just the way that Trump does things, and there wasn't anything major to report from the visit? There are no major shifts in US policy or anything like that?
I don't think there's anything remarkable to report. I mean, they did agree a few kind of commercial deals with America selling soya beans and aircraft to China. Obviously, the Americans got a bit of a bloody nose last year when the Chinese imposed on them a ban on what we call rare earth elements. Now, these are about a dozen magnets and minerals, which they don't cost very much. I mean, the value in global trade is very, very small. But if you don't have them, billions and billions of pounds worth or dollars worth of aircraft, you know, semiconductors, pretty much everything that we use nowadays would basically lie idle because these rare earths are really important. So Trump didn't want that kind of, he didn't want the Chinese kind of waving that in his face anymore. They've got to play for time there as well. But I think the thing that did cause consternation, you're quite right to point it out, was comments which Trump made, not in fact until he got home when he spoke to Fox News. And they asked him some questions about, you know, would you defend Taiwan? And, you know, are you going to sell arms to Taiwan? And some of these answers that he gave, the trouble with Trump is that you never know from one moment to the next whether his story is going to be consistent, because it often isn't. But the or if something was, gave were you a never, little bit equivocal.
You and never so, know if his answers are pre-planned or he's just saying something in the moment. Right.
Yeah, exactly. So the thing to watch really is whether there is a plan going through the American Congress to sell about, I don't know, $11 billion worth of arms to Taiwan. I mean, they do this quite regularly, but this is the latest arms shipment proposal. And the thing to watch actually is to whether that goes ahead. If it doesn't go ahead, I think that's a sign really that Trump's commitment to Taiwan may be wavering a bit.
Any noise from Taiwan? Any concerns from them? Or are they just ignoring that Fox interview?
Yeah, I think they probably feel by now that it's like they're raising their eyebrows thinking, oh, God, you know, not again. In the sense that, because they probably are getting used to the idea that, you know, they're sort of loved one minute and then, you know, in a bit of a toilet the next minute. And so... I should think it causes a bit of consternation for them to have this, well, it seems like an inconsistency. We'll see whether it is or not.
And what's, how real, give it, in a world where Russia did invade Ukraine, what's the threat likelihood of a Chinese invasion of Taiwan? Is it just like, is there something we should all be concerned about or no?
Well, I think we should be concerned that the Chinese might one day decide to lose their patience and mount a blockade or invade it. I don't think it's got anything to do with Ukraine, to be honest. And I don't think there's anything that we've seen this year, whether it's in Ukraine or in the Middle East, that actually has any bearing on on what the Chinese may or may not do with Taiwan. I don't think they want to invade.
I think that, and it's really helpful to get your view on this. Some of the concerns I've heard in like the political space is that because America is spread so thin in Iran and in and supporting of Ukraine, China might seize an opportunity. But you're suggesting that that won't really be a variable in their decision-making matrix.
I don't think so. I mean, yes, the Americans have had to withdraw, aircraft carriers and other naval assets from the South China Sea, but they can go back there pretty quickly. We can't get into this. I'm sure it's quite too complicated. There are all sorts of military lessons that I think the Chinese and the Americans will have learned from the war in Iran about drones and about, you know, how do you deal with ships that are trying to attack you through very, very vulnerable coastlines, where actually the advantage lies with the defender, not with the attacker. But I think the main thing for China really is they will use military force or a blockade against Taiwan if all else fails, and if Taiwan were to make a bigger kind of song and dance about wanting to be independent, and that were backed by the United States. I think that would really hack the Chinese off. But I think, we shouldn't make too light of the fact that going to war over Taiwan is a huge issue for China. They don't know that it would succeed. And if it did, they don't know that they would be any better off than the Americans have been in Iran.
Yeah, let's talk about Iran lastly before we move on to Vladimir Putin, because the closure of the Strait of Hormuz, the blockade that the Americans imposed, will have had impacts on China. What do they get? About 30-40% of their gas and oil from that region, at least, or it goes through?
Comes from the Gulf, yeah. Not just from Iran.
But from that region. That come up, surely they will have been... It's something that they would have spoken about.
You mean Xi Jinping and Trump?
Correct, yeah.
They did, by all accounts. I mean, usually on these summit meetings, both sides give what they call a readout. So the Americans give their version of what was discussed, and the Chinese give their version. That's kind of standard practice. But the two readouts didn't really match up this time. So the Americans said they spoke about Iran and that that the Chinese had given them undertakings that Iran should never have a nuclear device or bomb, and that the Straits of Hormuz should be opened as quickly as possible. The Chinese didn't really say anything about it. I think the Chinese do want stability in the Gulf. They have a vested interest that things should calm down. But they're not unhappy to see the Americans stressed about what's going on there, obviously.
Yeah, and... there was all sorts of noises. I don't know if it was ever true, but rumors. And I really don't want to. I mean, I could take you in a 45-minute conversation about the military tactics, but I'm sure our listeners might not appreciate that. But there were noises and rumors that the Chinese, through back channels, were providing some sort of at least geographical like intelligence to the Iranians during the war. But I don't know if that was ever verified.
Yeah, there were certainly stories about satellite intelligence.
Yeah.
If not, direct shipment of arms directly. I think a lot of it is rumor and speculation. It's almost certain that it cropped up at the summit meeting. The Americans say that the Chinese gave an undertaking they wouldn't be supplying arms to the Iranians, but I think nobody believes that the Chinese are not giving some kind of assistance.
Yeah, or at least testing some of the stuff that they may need to use sometime in the future, because it's a unique opportunity. Let's move on to Russia and China's relationship, because I think what's really interesting is the sort of common thinking in Britain is that Russia-China equals allies, right? Both sort of, you'd question whether they're communist, both either of them are communist countries, but by the by, most people think they're allies. You're suggesting the relationship is more complex than that. So what came out of this meeting and where is that relationship right now?
People are often looking for kind of a wedge, right, between the two. And probably there may have been a time when Donald Trump was looking for it too, by cozying up to Putin. He may have thought, the speculation is that he may have thought he could lever Putin away from China a little bit. I think if that was a kind of a half objective, I think it's a probably zero objective now. I think we all understand really that the Russians and the Chinese are in bed together. They don't have very much that unites them, except, of course, they have this antipathy towards the United States and to NATO. You know, basically the Russian economy would collapse if it weren't for China. Most of Russia's trade, or a large proportion of Russia's trade, has been redirected to China. Chinese banks provide a lot of financing for Russia. China buys a lot of oil and gas. They're helping Russia build a kind of an Arctic infrastructure for oil and gas exploration, which kind of helps explain the whole Greenland thing as well. There might come a point in the future when, when there is a falling out between the two or between the two countries, but I don't really see it happening for the foreseeable future. If anything, the Russians might even resent having this sort of very powerful neighbor to the east, which is effectively running their economy.
And they're so reliant on, right? That's part of what the anxiety
is. Oh, indeed, yeah.
Certainly absolutely. During a wartime economy, they can't be this reliant on a single country. And surely that means the Chinese have very specific asks and demands if they're that reliant.
They could use that leverage very, very effectively if they chose so to do, yeah.
Yeah.
I think that's probably what the Americans hope, is that they can try to use Chinese leverage over Putin to get him to accept some kind of, deal in Ukraine, but it hasn't happened as yet.
And the Chinese, they've been pretty quiet on Ukraine itself, or?
They want to be very quiet about it because, of course, they, in this sort of longstanding and no limits friendship, which they boast about with Putin between them, they are providing effectively Russia's wherewithal to be able to prosecute the war. In Europe, we should remember that when we kind of cozy up to Xi Jinping, then you can't really cozy up to Xi Jinping and support Ukraine at the same time, really. It doesn't really make any sense. There's no kind of hiding the fact that China is helping Russia directly and probably indirectly fighting that war. It's a big issue for Europeans.
So
to deal with, yeah.
George, last question. I've got like 40 seconds, but I can't. Where is Xi Jinping's sort of grasp on power in China? Is it as strong as it's ever been?
I think it is. Obviously we can't really deal with this within now, probably in 30 seconds. But yeah. One of the things that cropped up earlier this year is he purged the final generals on the Central Military Commission, which is the most important military body in China. So there's only him on it now with one junior general. So people thought that was a sign that he was losing his grip. It probably means his grip is still pretty strong.
Yeah, and tightening. Yeah, it's a single person panel. It's how I run the show, actually, right today. It's just me in the studio. Well, thank you so much. Listen, I could have you on for probably weeks and days, and I'd love to have you back on. That's been George Magnus, Research Associate at China Center, Oxford University, and at SOAS, and the author of Red Flags, Why Xi's China is in Jeopardy. So do make sure you check out that book. Thank you so much, George. That's it from Politics Uncensored today. Join us next Thursday at 5 p.m. where we unwrap the week's political talking points. You can stay up to date with the show by following at Politics Uncensored UK on social media, where you can find me at Ali Milani. If you missed any of today's show, you can listen back and catch up at FUBARradio.com or via the FUBAR Radio app. Thanks for listening. See you next week for another episode of Politics Uncensored.
FUBAR Radio.